Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. This is part two of our Weird Predictions of Yesteryear episode. I'm Ben, and you know what? I already need to correct myself. Noel, I don't think all of those predictions were all that weird. Some of them were pretty accurate. What do you say?
Some of them were pretty accurate, Ben. Some of them were pretty, you know, cogent in terms of like within the realm of possibility. We kind of reserved some of the more bizarro ones for this episode, I would say. Episode one was mainly concerned with farming and sustenance and food trends. And maybe, you know, again, a lot of these people that are making these predictions, they're big brainiac types. And so they like to speak with authority. There's nothing less attractive than like hedging on a future prediction, because you have to say it with utter authority or else you might as well just not say it at all. So I would say everything that was in episode one, even if it hasn't come to pass, like the underwater kelp fields, you know, I could see that, a world where maybe there's something like that, or certainly there are like tanks, you know, that where you grow like hydroponically and things like that. So there's versions of a lot of those things. Today we're getting into like weird, wild stuff, as Johnny Carson would say. And we're going to start in the underwater realm. But mainly focusing on transportation. But we're going to stick with underwater for a while. First off, in the 21st century, it was predicted by the French artist Jean-Marc Cote. Cote? Case?
Cote. Jean-Marc Cote.
Ah, Casey on the case. Da-da. French artist, I would argue surrealist artist, based on what you're about to hear, Jean-Marc Cote, and many of his contemporaries in the art world produced over 100 of these illustrations of what the year 2000, in the year 2000, apparently we will ride on giant seahorses.
Yep, and I love the idea. I love art. I love futurism. Giant seahorses would have to be genetically created. They don't exist at this time. By the way, that's super producer Casey Pagram. It was our Casey on the case there. They didn't stop there. They had something that might even be a little bit more plausible, which is the idea of a whale pulling an entire kind of underwater bus of people through the sea. And whales do exist. Whales are quite intelligent. So maybe we could convince some whales to help people. There's another shot where there's like a fish race. Picture a horse race, but instead of horses, the jockeys are these scuba divers on these enormous fish. There are enormous fish. We just don't know of any that are super down with being ridden like race animals.
There's also a super weird one that's almost like reverse fishing, where there are these like underwater, like helmet frogmen type figures fishing for seagulls. They are underwater already, and they have like presumably fish bait or some sort of seagull bait, I guess, in this scenario, on strings that they're bobbing up to the top of the water. And then when the seagulls dive in to get it, they like jerk the seagulls underwater. Mm-hmm. What would you want with a seagull? It's bad luck to kill a seabird. Everybody knows that who's seen the lighthouse, but also they're notoriously gamey and stringy and gross to eat.
Yeah, it's more of like a flex or a revenge thing, I think, because seagulls are some of the most cantankerous of birds, up there with the shoebill. They're some of the only birds I don't particularly care for.
Well, you know my position, but Ben, you are a friend of birds in general, and you're right. I think I've mentioned that the seagull might actually be the origin of my fear of birds. Right. As a small child, I believe I was dive-bombed by them. But then you get into some more, like, kind of, some of these, I think, are, like, they're really styling.
I do want to point out these all come from, what I was going to say is these all come from the Public Domain Review.
Yes.
I think this is an excellent resource. Mm-hmm. If you're on Twitter or something like that, follow them. They have the greatest stories all the time. But Noel, you want to describe some of these art pieces here?
Absolutely. And you can find this specifically at publicdomainreview.org/collections/ all separated by dashes, a 19th century vision of the year 2000 in numbers separated by dashes. We need to start doing show notes for the show, maybe. We can talk about that. New year, new way of doing things. But some of these, I think, are kind of styling, where they're like, I don't know that these artists necessarily believe that in the future we would be riding on giant seahorses underwater. I think it might have been just kind of like artistic license for like, ooh, what would be the craziest thing that could happen in the year 2000? Some of them are more functional, though. You've got one where it's like a gentleman running an entire farm remotely from like what looks sort of like a railway switching panel or like a old school elevator, where he's got like a kind of like lever and then like a series of buttons on this panel, all connected to these like power line looking things that are connected to threshers that are running on these lines that are using them to like guide their path to like cut the wheat. There are like wheat kind of bales, or maybe it's honeycomb or something. But the idea is, I think that these lines are remotely running all these threshers and that one man can do all this work himself. And you got, Ben, I think something that's the most prevalent here is lots of depictions of flying machines.
Yes. I do want to pause, though, before we go on there. There's one that really stood out to me. It's a classroom scene. You can see it here on the site. I know you can see it in Tunnel, where there's someone who looks like an older schoolmaster who's feeding books into what looks to be a crank-operated shredder. Mm-hmm. And then these electric wires lead to these headphones and skull caps. And there are students just sitting there with their hands folded on their desk. That technology, symbolically, I would argue, is already around in the form of audiobooks and, dare we say it, podcast.
Right.
So I feel like that one's accurate, but through the lens of arts.
What happens to the books, though, Ben? Do you lose the books? It looks like the books would be like shredded into pulp and then converted into some kind of electronic signal that can then shoot through these wires. It's a very interesting image with this one poor little boy cranking the crank while the schoolmaster just shoves the books into this kind of like feeder.
He's a human turnspit dog.
Exactly.
So this art is well worth your time if you're a fan of this kind of fanciful view of the future stuff. But you're right, Noel. People are fascinated with air travel at this time. We have to remember that the first flight of the Wright brothers took place December 17th, 1903. And during this time and leading up to this, people were obsessed with the idea that we would one day take to the air. I think it was 1913, the first commercial flight occurs from Florida to Tampa. It carries one person. Mm-hmm. It was like the level of flex that you would associate with billionaires traveling to the outer reaches of gravity just for like a few seconds nowadays.
That's exactly right, Ben. And the thing that's so remarkable about some of these, so many of these images, all of these in this collection, is that they just have that kind of Jules Verne, you know, like retro steampunk, I don't know if that's right, but it's kind of this retro futuristic quality to them, where there's a lot of like flying suits, where there'll be a man kind of in like a winged suit, you know, up there soaring right next to the Zeppelin or like, you know, biplane situation. But most of them are odd kind of styles on that. Like there's one that looks sort of like a hot air balloon basket that has like a helicopter propeller on the top and sort of this like arrow looking ballast thing on either side. Then you have people in winged suits flying up to an eagle's nest, presumably robbing them of their eggs or poaching them or something like that. It's a little weird. And then you've got like ones that we've seen in movies like Sky Captain and The World of Tomorrow, this like image of the future with a lot of these machines that logistically don't really make any sense. Like there's one where the wings on the flying machine actually flap. And has a tail. I don't think that would work. I don't think that's the way aerodynamics quite functions. But so you got a lot of like dubious science and a lot of style over function here. And then you've got like a blimp situation. We know the fascination about blimps and zeppelins, you know, when it comes to thinking about the future.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these illustrations remind me of Well, I think they possibly inspired one of my favorite books, the Codex Serafinianus, which is an illustrated encyclopedia of an imaginary world. I think, Casey, Noel, you guys might have seen it the last time you were over at my house. Did I ever show you guys that one? If not, I'll bring it in. It's nuts. Just check it out. The reason I mention it is because of the fanciful illustrations. But these illustrations, these flights of fancy.
Do it.
Don't come from.
Done.
Yeah, don't come from thin air. Because we know that, like you said, Noel, there was this rich cultural soil from which they sprang in the zeitgeist. People were honestly predicting that we would, by this time in human history, that we would all have personal airplanes. And full disclosure, folks, some people do have personal airplanes. Your faithful, ridiculous historians here, however, we do not. I think Le Bouche may have maybe a small prop plane somewhere in France. But Casey, that's more for your off-the-grid work stuff, right?
That's true. I was just going to jump in to say, it took me a second to recall the book, but the Codex is really, really worth investigating. It's a really, really cool book. The illustrations are amazing. And it's just one of those one-of-a-kind bizarre objects in the world. It's really, really cool.
It makes no sense either. You know, it's from 1981, but I think he was inspired by a lot of the art that we're discussing in the opening of today's episode. And it's funny, you know, the stuff about personal airplanes dates back to what? No, 1930, Frederick Edwin Smith published this book called The World in 2030 AD. And he said, everybody's going to own a small airplane. It's going to be perfect for weekend trips. You know, you can go to Greenland and ski, and then you can come back and, I don't know. So weird.
I will say this. I mean, you know, I think the closest thing we have to like personal crafts like that would be the helicopter, which is obviously, you know, still within the realm of like, you know, super, super high level wealth. Because we were talking off air, it would be very difficult to like logistically deal with like the traffic of like everyone having an airplane and just like air traffic, as difficult as it already is for commercial flights. Can you imagine like having everyone like have an aircraft, and then how would you deal with that? You'd have to communicate with some sort of air traffic control or like have really, really good radar. I don't know. What do you guys think? What would life be like? I feel like there would be just crashes, like just wreckage falling out of the sky left and right on the daily.
This is a longstanding, I won't call it an argument. We'll call it a healthy conversation I had with my old ride or die, Scott Benjamin, on our show Car Stuff. Flying cars are one of those things that are always eternally just on the horizon. The only way they could happen safely is if they are autonomous vehicles controlled by a grid. That's the only way it can happen. Otherwise, flying cars are still one of those things where it's a matter of, how's the best way to say it? It's amazing if I have a flying car, says one person, and no one else does. But it's a bloodbath if everybody has a flying car. It just, we don't have the skills as human operators to live in a world of personal flight machines in a safe way, unless we have a huge jump in technology or unless they're autonomous. I say that as someone who does think the idea is really cool, but even if you gave everybody on the planet their own personal bicycle, we would still see tons of accidents. We're just not ready for individual flying cars unless they're robot controlled.
That's right. You made the really good point off air, Ben, when we were talking about autonomous cars and how that's sort of becoming less of a priority. I think, what did we say? Uber is out.
Yeah.
And you made the really great point that autonomous vehicles only works if it's 100% opt-in. Like, when you have any level of human error involved in the equation, it screws up the whole algorithm and makes the whole thing dangerous. So it's kind of an all or nothing situation, right?
Yeah, that's true. Like, imagine a line of dominoes, or whatever pattern of dominoes you want to imagine. And each of those dominoes is an autonomous vehicle, except for one. And the one domino is not controlled by the falling of the other dominoes. So when it is supposed to move with the system, it just doesn't. The system automatically breaks because of that one domino. That's a very lazy way to put it. But we're working live here, Noel. We're working live. Also, unrelated to anything, did you see that meme? I didn't realize this, but the original Mad Max takes place this year.
Oh, no. We're getting there. We're not too far there. Off. Yeah, man, this is really interesting stuff. And, you know, I think one thing that we have seen over time, we know this to be true. We always talk about how life expectancy back in the, you know, olden days of life on the prairies or, you know, in the medieval times, life expectancy was not good. And that was because, you know, there were plagues and there was really bad ideas when it came to medicine and treating illnesses and things that would actually make you get sicker and very, you know, poor conditions when it came to childbirthing and your chances of living through bearing children were super low. So as we've seen technology progress and, you know, humanity move forward, people's life expectancies have seemed to jump. But one thing that was predicted because of technology and this very thing in the 21st century was that we would live to be old, like really old. Like really, really old.
People have been thinking about this for centuries. Benjamin Franklin, the one and only Benny F., had even written about this as far back as the late 1700s. In 1788, he wrote a letter to Reverend John Lathrop where he said, you know, within a few years, we're going to live as long as those people from the Old Testament, from the book of Genesis. We're going to be like Noah. We'll be 950 years old.
Who is that super old one? Methuselah?
That's the one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 969 years old. I think Methuselah made it. And we can go into where that comes from, maybe on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Check out that show. But the weird thing is, just like the pattern we established in part one of our predictions episode, the weird thing here is that it's an extreme claim, an extreme prediction, but it appears to have some degree of accuracy. People are living longer. People are healthier for longer in many parts of the world. And if you look at the science on the horizon, the medical research on the horizon, then we may be able to extend people's lives. Currently, we can't extend someone's organic life to almost 1,000 years, but we may be able to, it depends. We're waxing philosophical when we get to this part, but we may be able to extend someone's life indefinitely by making a copy of their mind on a digital platform, like turning their mind into code and then keeping that mind on a hard drive somewhere or in a cloud. That'll probably happen before we can get to 900 years old and still be hale and hearty. But you know, I've always been interested in this. This is a question for you guys. Given the option, would you want to live for 900 plus years? Let's not make it a monkey's paw situation. Would you want to live for 900 plus years if you knew you would be relatively healthy until, say, like the last 5 years?
It's a hard one, man, because, you know, you might say it when you're young, but then realize that you just get bored and you just, I don't know, maybe it's like it is a monkey's paw situation or it's, you know, a devil's bargain. You think of like the Interview with the Vampire and all these characters that kind of live to see all their friends die. And like, I don't know, maybe if I knew that everyone that I loved was also going to live that long, then I'd be cool with it, but I wouldn't want to like outlive everybody in my life and then be sad and alone living in some sort of like virtual reality brain cloud machine.
Yeah, what if you could do it physically? I mean, I'll tell you, I would immediately go to space and I would be like, all right, I got 950 years, I'm going to spend the first 250 traveling out somewhere. I'm just going to turn around and come back.
It sort of makes me think of the concept behind this really cool Philip K. Dick book called Ubik, or Ubik, maybe. It's the idea where people are able to actually die And through this corporation, their bodies are kept in cryo state, and their minds are like put into this cloud type scenario. So they're able to kind of like their souls are able to live on, even if their bodies have actually, or their brains have died. I'm not remembering it very precisely, but it is, again, a lot of these ideas, it makes sense that they're coming from these science fiction writers or people like that, because so much of science fiction is just like thought experiments about like, ooh, what if like we progressed as a society, just this one little thing a little further than is within our grasp right now, how would that change our interactions with each other and with society in general? And I think that's why people still love science fiction to this day.
Yeah, yeah. And also along that vein, if you enjoy the Philip K. Dick story that Noel just recommended, I think you'll also enjoy Fall or Dodge in Hell by Neal Stephenson, which has a very similar kind of thing. The only catch is, and this isn't a spoiler, but the only catch is the virtual world in Fall or Dodge in Hell is, for some reason, a medieval fantasy world. So if you like Neal Stephenson, he's weird. If you like Neal Stephenson, you haven't read him yet, check that out.
I read one of his in audiobook form that I can't remember the name. It was about like a lot of things. It was about like a like gold farming in Dungeons and Dragons, or in like what's that game? That online game, World of Warcraft, where you can literally like gold, like farm for gold and then sell it for real money.
Remedy.
Yeah, it's about like a some sort of worm. What do you call it? Like a invasive piece of malware, and like a heist, like an online heist of all this, like, you know, farmed gold and espionage, and he's really all over the place and really, really interesting. And I believe he wrote Snow Crash as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he wrote Snow Crash. He wrote Anathema, which is a book I dearly love. But yes, Neal Stephenson is another iteration, or his work is another iteration of this larger pattern that you just outlined, Noel, of science fiction through thought experimentation, exploring the possibilities of the future world. And now that we're talking sci-fi, we can go to another very sensitive topic. Spoiler alert, you don't have to be a fan of history to realize this. People, since people existed, have always been talking about the weather. We used to have entire like religious things built along the passage of the seasons and the weather, and we still to a degree do. One of the things that people predicted back in the early 1900s is that one day, perhaps in the coming century, we would be able to control the weather specifically to make rain. On January 6th, 1910, Iowa's Cedar Rapids Evening Gazette came out with this article that said, yes, we are one day going to be able to control rain. In the 21st century, they said, we will be the masters of moisture. I just made that up. They would have written it much better, a much better phrase. But that turned out to actually be sort of true, which is amazing.
Well, I mean, we've talked about this before, and whether we can call it actually weather control or not is maybe debatable, but the idea of cloud seeding, right? Like where you can pump stuff up into clouds using, what is it, like iodine, so some kind of like chemical that you can use, and you can make it rain, but that doesn't mean that you can make it not rain. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You can't really control it if you can only work it one way. But you also, do you really see that used during drought? I mean, we still obviously have terrible droughts. We haven't cracked the code on how to like not have droughts. So obviously this cloud seeding thing will only get you so far, right?
Yeah, see, that's the problem. The concept of cloud seeding has been around for a while now. It wasn't around 1910, but it's been around for decades at this point. Silver iodide particles are injected into clouds. Yeah, and the problem is it's a drink your milkshake situation to a degree, because that cloud seeding does not create water. It gathers water to these clouds, and then that water becomes rain. So you're taking that water from somewhere. The government of China, just a few weeks ago in December of 2020, they announced that they're going to expand their weather modification program to get this cover 2.1 million square miles. That's more than 1.5 times the size of India. So where's that water coming from? They're using it to combat drought. But I love your point. I think you make a fantastic point. We know how to start the process, but it's maybe a little optimistic to say we know how to control it, right?
That's right. Ben, didn't China use cloud seeding as like a kind of special effect during the Olympics to like do some kind of crazy display during the opening ceremonies?
Yeah. I think you're correct, Noel. I didn't personally see it, but it's definitely a flex that is within their weather wheelhouse. Wheelhouse of weather. W-O-W, like World of Warcraft.
Wow, indeed. Yeah, the headline from Business Insider from 2016 is, China spent millions on a shady project to control the weather ahead of the Beijing Olympics. And that millions is $30 million. And their version of it involved shooting, quote, salt and mineral-filled bullets into the sky in order to make it rain for entertainment purposes. So, we're sort of there. I don't know that this is something that there's some research going into it, but it's not something we hear about a lot. And it certainly doesn't seem to have solved drought or wildfires or like any of the like things that the weather does that totally screw us over as human beings. So I would say this is a no, that we have not figured out how to control the weather, wield it to our own purposes yet.
Yeah, I am unfortunately tempted to agree, man, because we also see other predictions about weather that are incredibly optimistic because the weather has kind of gone downhill over the past few centuries. There are people who predicted that hurricanes would one day be a thing of the past. In 1950, in Popular Mechanics, a fellow named Waldemar Kampfert said that hurricanes are going to be a non-issue by the year 2000. And he said they would be a non-issue, not because we would prevent them from forming, but because once we saw one over the ocean, we would start a large oil fire across the water, drawing air from the region and somehow ending the hurricane. He also thought we'd be able to divert storms, etc. He was incredibly wrong on multiple accounts, but, you know, he was doing his best, I guess. By the way, Tesla also was incorrect with his predictions about weather. I think he said we would end deforestation and prevent forest fires.
Smokey the Bear would be disappointed. But it still is up to you to prevent forest fires because we haven't figured it out like as a collective. So each individual has to do their part. So another funny weather related one, and this is sort of like in the stuff kind of category, right? Like what will our stuff be like in the future? Well, according to Waldemar Kampfert, in the future, everything in our homes will be waterproof. Another one of these like underwater dwelling kind of future scenarios. He believed that everything in the future, including the drapes, rugs, upholstery on couches, anything you could put your hands on would be made of waterproof plastic. Remember when plastic was like the wave of the future? This seems to be coming from that kind of mentality that everything should be made of plastic because it's the wonder material. If only they knew about nanoplastics and gives us all cancer. Topic for another day. And that our homes would have like built-in drainage systems like in the floor. So after, we would literally be able to hose down everything in our house to clean it off. And then the water would just, bloop, bloop down the drain. And then, like car wash style, there'd be a blast of heated air that would dry everything off. This one is absurd, I have to say. Maybe the most.
We've got, we have a thing like this in bathrooms, in restrooms, in different parts of the world. Like you'll go to a hotel or a hostel maybe, and you'll see that the entire restroom is the shower area. Have you ever seen those? They've got like the faucet hooks directly into the sink and there's a drain just in the middle of the floor. The commode's still there. It's just when you want to shower, you just hit a switch on the sink and then you take the shower head off the rack.
Yeah. Also great for like a murder room. You know, if you need, if you need such, because then everything just drains down the drain and you can rinse it all off and you got a fresh start. But yeah, this is true, Ben. We do have something like this, but they're all kind of more in the realm of bathrooms. Yeah. Or possibly you might have a drain in a garage situation for like a car wash, maybe, or, you know, something like that. Like a foot rinsing station if you live by the beach.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned, kill rooms, though. That's going to sound weird out of context. We're going somewhere with it. Because
take me there, babe.
I immediately thought of the show Dexter. You remember Dexter?
Of course, of course.
So Dexter had this pretty consistent depiction of a kill room on television. And people argue all sorts of things about television and the things depicted upon it. But there were a lot of predictions about the future of television in the 21st century. Imagine. So, like, according to some of these futurists, by this point in history, we should be able to watch a show like Dexter, or let's take another example, watch a show like Hannibal and smell the food cooking or feel the texture of different things depicted on the show. Nicholas Negroponte, who was a former director of MIT's Media Lab, said that we'll have full-color, large-scale, holographic television with force feedback and olfactory output by the 21st century, meaning that you could see stuff on television and you would feel it and you would smell it. Here's the thing, man. I don't know if I want that.
Mm-mm. No. And honestly, I think attempts to do stuff like this, which is still around, I think 3D cinema is a gimmick, and it hurts my eyeballs and makes me kind of want to recoil in horror. I don't really care for it. And I went and saw a movie with my daughter and her friends. It was an anime, and there's this, like, I don't know, they call it 4D theater at the fancy movie theater pre-COVID times, where the seats actually move around. They kind of jerk you around, and there are little spritzers on the side of the seats that, like, shoot puffs of air at you, and there's air stuff happening, and even moisture, and possibly smells. I don't recall. There were no smells in this one, but also at the Legoland at one of our malls here, they have a 4D cinema that does involve smells. And it's just so gimmicky, and I just don't see it. Doesn't really integrate into, like, the experience of it. Like, I get what it is, but it doesn't really add anything to it other than, like, oh, this is cute, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
I know that there have been some companies doing research into how to create a smell machine, but I'm with you, man. I don't know if I really want to smell what I'm watching, or if I necessarily want that tactile feedback all the time. And I agree with you. I think a lot of us in the audience today can remember how television manufacturers had this ill-fated push to create 3D at-home televisions, and it was a top-down push, and a lot of people didn't like it. So it's not just a question of whether the technology exists. It's also a question of whether there's a demand for it. So let us know if you are a fan of smell-o-vision and why. There's another question here. I think it's one that we'd be remiss if we didn't mention. It's the world of medicine. We know that predictions of future miraculous cures are a tale as old as time. Back in 1956, there was a Swiss doctor named Francois Oddi who said that by this time in this century, by the 21st century, all the victories that were the pride of brilliant surgeons will be forgotten, replaced by the discovery of, quote, a substance which, in the form of a capsule, will capture the sources of energy that will bring recovery within hours. So it's just like one miracle pill for everything. What a world. That would be amazing, right?
Oof. Yeah, I mean, it would be amazing, sure, but is that not, that's like not how medicine works, right? There's no one pill to cure them all, like Lord of the Rings style. I mean, there's like nuances in each individual patient, each individual malady. This is very like utopian future sci-fi type stuff, way outside of the realm of just like a pill that is like your meal of sustenance. This, I don't know that there's any scenario where this would make any kind of sense, unless it was was like made of like nano beings or something that could then just like zoom around inside your body and find the particular part that was ailing you and fix you up.
Yeah, yeah. The quest for a panacea is a long quest, and it's one that hasn't reached an endpoint yet. I think you're right, Noel. If there's something that would be analogous to a pill of this sort, it would have to be some kind of nanotechnology that would be able to diagnose and immediately treat your body and everything that ails it. And then at that point, you would just need to take it as soon as possible. Take it before you're sick so it could apply preventative treatment. So far, Odie's prediction has not come to pass, but we still have several years left in the 21st century, to say the least. One of my favorites, and this is so weird, one of my favorite concepts, I had not heard of this before, is the concept of the grouch pill.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real. I mean, we certainly have something approaching this in terms of antidepressants, but they wouldn't have thought of it quite as high-mindedly back in 1966. This was back when kelp was really big again, the kind of the health food driven economy. And they were thinking about how can we improve relations between married couples when one of them is in a particularly nasty mood. And the Rand Corporation, you'll recall, who are the ones that sort of set forth this whole idea of the underwater fields of kelp, as far as the eye can see, tended by frogmen, they described a world where you could pop down to the corner drugstore, buy some anti-grouch pills, and slip them into their coffee. So that's basically encouraging you to drug your partner, essentially. But we can leave that aside for now. But of course, this is another kind of like very simplified version of what antidepressants are. They work differently on different people. They take quite a long time to actually kick in. It's not something you can just dose somebody with and then magically they're happy. I mean, sure, there are drugs like that, but those are called like hard drugs, like heroin or cocaine, that make you happy instantly, but then long-term effects of those are addiction and extra grouchiness or worse.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, we see there's some real-world things that could be called grouch pills. But the problem is, as you said, Noel, I think the problem is in the specifics of that prediction. I don't think you should unknowingly drug your partner. Is that a hot take? I hope not. I feel like if you have a romantic relationship with someone, it should be founded on trust rather than surreptitiously drugging them. And in that way, I would deem this a less than optimistic prediction about the 21st century. Now, so far, folks, so far, dear ridiculous historians, we have been pretty honest, but pretty optimistic as well with our predictions. We've been talking about people saying nice things. People weren't always saying nice things. In fact, there were a few less than optimistic, somewhat strange predictions about the 21st century. Noel, you know, the weirdest one to me is the future humans one.
This is where things get pretty interesting. This is like sort of in the realm of like body modification or like, you know, what we evolve to be a certain way. I mean, yeah, there's this idea that seems really strange and dystopian that in the future, humans will only need one eye. We'll all be cyclopses. This was put forth by Dr. Thomas Hall Shosted in a 1933 article called The Face of the Future. And he says, the future eye will be in the center of the face, below a very high forehead, where the bridge of the nose once rested. We won't need noses. That was a Back to the Future reference. The doctor said that the human eye originally had evolved to see into the distance, but we don't need that anymore because we're not like hunters. You know, we get our food served to us in pill form. All we need to be able to do is read and write and repair watches, he says. Also cut gems. These are all very, you know, modern things. And look at pictures and so forth. And he says the cyclopean eye would evolve to accommodate all these close range tasks and pastimes. Wow.
Jeez.
That's a lot.
That guy's a doctor, too, has a very low opinion of us. I don't know how serious that prediction is, but it seems like he's being sincere, you know? And then, of course, there's a lot of cantankerous stuff about the way new technologies will affect future humans. One Time article from 1951 said that people are becoming less literate due to the rise of television, and said that eventually people in the age of television would not be able to read. Specifically, this writer said, by the 21st century, our people doubtless will be squint-eyed, hunchbacked, and fond of the dark. But why am I carrying on like this? Chances are that the grandchildren of the television age won't know how to read this. Tut, tut. What a weird diss. So hopefully that's a little bit of satire. We know that people are encountering literature in different ways, but it's not like literature no longer exists. I know a lot of people who read books. I would say maybe this writer from the 1950s should consider directing their ire at the rise of the calculator. How many people can easily do sums? When's the last time you had to do some long division, for instance, without tech assistance?
A 1,000,000%. We've talked about this so often, where it's like, do our brains, how do they change based on the information that we no longer need them for? Like, remembering phone numbers or whatever. Like, do they fill that space up with other stuff, or do we just kind of lose it? Is it like a use it or lose it situation? I know that, you know, the mind and is very elastic and has a way of adapting to things like that. But it is an interesting thought, especially when you think about the extreme kind of evolution that he's describing here, which would presumably take like millions of years,
yes.
Right? To evolve into having a single eye. That's not the kind of thing that would happen like in anyone's lifetime.
True, true. And I think the evolution of humanity is now a conversation with technology, but I don't think television is going to render people illiterate. Maybe it just changes the way we encounter literature. So let's bring it all the way back around to the very beginning of part one of our predictions episode. Nikola Tesla, he had some really, really nice, optimistic predictions too. And I don't want to say they're wrong, because I also strive to be optimistic. But I will say we have what? We have like 80 years to work on these, round about 79.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, mm-hmm. what are some of your favorites, man?
Well, there's a lot. There's so much. We've covered so many weird ones, like pretty close to accurate ones, ones that we're seeing little shades of in our day-to-day life. A couple, I want to end on Mr. Tesla, because he did make a couple of fun ones that actually have come to pass, mm-hmm. in very, very real and meaningful ways. One being the whole notion, the concept of a smartphone. Or let's just call it a cell phone. Mm-hmm. He said in a 1909 interview with the New York Times that was published in Popular Mechanics, quote, it will soon be possible, for instance, for a businessman in New York to dictate instructions and have them appear in type in London or elsewhere. He will be able to call from his desk and talk with any telephone subscriber, he even uses the word subscriber,
right,
in the world. It will only be necessary to carry an inexpensive instrument, no bigger than a watch, which will enable its bearer to hear anywhere on sea or land for distances of thousands of miles. One may listen to or transmit speech or song to the uttermost parts of the world. Wow.
Amazing. Yeah, he was spot on with this one, which gives us a little hope that maybe he'll one day be right with his prediction that news headlines won't focus on crime and politics. In 1935, in Liberty Magazine, he said, "Today, the most civilized countries of the world spend a maximum of their income on war and a minimum on education. The 21st century will reverse this order. It will be more glorious to fight against ignorance than to die on the field of battle." How amazing would that be? Nick, if you're listening, I hope you're right.
I guess he's not familiar with the expression, if it bleeds, it leads. Right. We still seem to operate squarely under that principle. So I would say that's a big no, but would love to see that happen. It's going to require a whole lot of consensus and a lot of just changing of attitudes, you know? And who knows? I mean, 2020 was a rough year. Moving into 2021, it would be foolish to think that all of a sudden things are going to change for the better overnight. But it does feel like the discourse is maybe moving towards something more representing a consensus, or a little bit more. What is the word? Lowering the temperature of discourse and of rhetoric and all of that. So we'll see. Again, like you said, Ben, I too like to be optimistic. One thing that Tesla absolutely got right more than 100 years ago that isn't a particularly, I don't know, it's not net unpositive. There are certainly positive uses for these things, but the idea of unmanned aerial vehicles, or what we love to talk about, you know, on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, drones, the idea of drone warfare. And Nikola Tesla actually had a pretty optimistic view of what these devices would accomplish. He said he actually has a patent for something resembling a drone. It's like a drone ship. But he believed that radio waves would be able to be used as communication technology that would transmit messages between like a master and a host in this drone, and be able to use them to carry out warfare operations. But he referred to them as drone peacekeeping.
Yeah. And he was right. He called it a century ago. He predicted the path we would take. And as you said, Noel, it is a path fraught with complications. It could be seen as a net positive. It certainly was seen as a net positive by Tesla. But so he was right about cell phones. He was right about drones. We're hoping he's right about the emphasis on science over war. And we're also hoping he's right on one of his most optimistic predictions, the idea that a Department of Hygiene would eliminate pollution and world hunger. He said by the year 2035, there would be enough wheat and wheat products. Because remember, from our earlier episode, the guy loved honey, milk, and wheat.
Health food nut.
He said there will be enough of this stuff to feed the entire world, including parts of the world that have been chronically on the verge of starvation or experience food insecurity. And he said long before the next century dawns, systematic reforestation and the scientific management of natural resources will have made an end of all devastating droughts, forest fires, and floods. Oh, and he also predicted that we would be done with the necessity of burning fuel, and there would be no such thing as unsafe drinking water. Tesla, we're trying our best, man. Let's just say we're running a little late with that one.
Yeah, we sure are. I want to circle back to drones just really quickly, because, again, I sort of briefly mentioned that he thought of these as a method of keeping the peace. And the reason is he felt that his patent for a drone, these unmanned vehicles, would, quote, this is from a tweet from Matt Schroyer, would bring about world peace through mutually assured destruction, in the same way that, like, the H-bomb did. But unfortunately, there's a really good quote from John Oliver from Last Week Tonight, where he says that drones didn't have that same effect because so much of what drones do happen in secret. And you don't have that same spectacle and that same theater and that same shock and awe as you do with a singular event like dropping an H-bomb and seeing an associated mushroom cloud that everyone can like ooh and ah over and experience the fear of God, right?
Yeah, right. That's the problem. Technology always outpaces legislation, and we are now in a world where it's difficult to make solid predictions about so much of the future. One thing we can predict, though, hopefully, is that you have enjoyed this two-part episode, and we predict, I think we can safely predict, that we are going to be making more of these episodes in the future, so long as our super producer, Casey Pegram, sticks with us, as long as we don't get on your nerves too much. Right, Casey?
I'm here for the long haul, guys.
Oh, thanks, man. We appreciate it. And we're here for you for the long haul and for you, Ridiculous Historians. So, and you can be there for us or for each other in whatever form you see fit, as long as it involves, you know, the internet. You can find us on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, where we're Ridiculous History. If you would like, you can join our Facebook group, Ridiculous Historians, where you can participate in conversations and engage with your fellow Ridiculous Historians.
And you can also find us as individuals. You can talk to me directly. I'm on Instagram at Ben Bullen. You can also find me on Twitter at Ben Bullen HSW.
Huge thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, as always, Alex Williams, who composed this theme, Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit.
Our wonderful research associate, Gabe Luzier. Thanks to you, Gabe. Thanks also to our own mad scientist, Jonathan Strickland. Thanks to Eves Jeffcoat, our peer podcaster, friend of the show. Do check out her fantastic podcast, This Day in History Class.
Yes, please do. And, you know, hope your new year is treating you well. Let us know what the cutoff for calling it a new year is. I would love to know.
Why don't we just call it the new year until, like, September?
You know what? I'm cool with that. Weigh in, though. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.